accession number 18751, reel 3.
Okay, John. Now you know you're a transport man, and obviously you came back to Lynham.
Yes.
Which was the sort of, I suppose it's the RAF Gatwick, isn't it, or the RAF Heathrow, one of them.
It's the RAF Gatwick.
What year was that you came back?
63, 64. Yeah, that's right.
And they were operating what, Britannias then?
No, they had Comet 2s, Comet 4s, and Britannias, Mark 1s and 2s, and we had. Great difficulty in those days because we had two aircraft which had the same fin numbers, but they had different letters. But if you went out to do, you had to be very careful. If you told to go and do a job on 392, you would ask Comet or Britannia, if you were switched on, that was. We did all sorts of work from Lynham in those days, went all over the world again with those aircraft.
I mean, this was moving troops around?
Yes, moving troops, famines, reliefs. Biafra was a horrendous experience, Biafra. When you saw the kiddies out there.
You went out there, did you?
Yes, I did. Yes,
can you
I
tell
did.
Me a bit about it?
I was at home on the weekend, and I was called in to work on the Saturday evening. On the Sunday, we left to go out to Lusaka. We got to Lusaka, and the aircraft, the Britannias, were doing runs into the Belgian Congo and back out again, mainly with children, which had been orphaned. And stupid we were in those days, we would give the kiddies milk, chocolate, and of course they used to bring it straight back up again because they had no resistance at all. They had no food, they were starving. And we then spoke to the Red Cross and said, or they spoke to us and said, "What if you want to help, give them boiled water with a half teaspoonful of glucose in it and a half teaspoonful of salt. And they will keep that down. And that's the best thing you can do for them." And that's exactly what we did. And we sort of started them off.
What were you actually doing with the children? Getting them out of the war zone or what?
Yeah, getting them out of the war zone, and then the Red Cross would take them off our hands. And I believe they flew them into places in like Switzerland, somewhere like this. But the Red Cross took over.
I mean, what do they do in Switzerland? They just fed them up a bit.
I think they fed them up a bit. And I believe, I don't know, but I believe they sort of got them into families, adopted, because these kiddies were orphaned, and it was suddenly developed, and then all of a sudden it was stopped, because they realised that they were taking a generation away from their natural habitats. And we were at Angola, Lusaka, Nairobi, and we were out there for about 3 months.
You didn't actually go into Biafra, did you?
No. The air crew coming back, their horrendous stories were enough.
They actually went to Biafra, didn't they?
They did, yes. The air crew did, yeah. Mm. But, they flew in there most of the time. But these were with Britannias. And then, after the Belgian Congo, we came home again, and we went to all these trouble zones. The Kenya, Mau Mau, Pakistan, flood release, all these sort of emergencies.
Supplies in.
Yes, yeah. We were, it was very, very, well, I would say nerve-wracking, but it was upsetting because we flew in a load of rice, tons of rice, and we had nowhere to put it. And we said to the authorities in Pakistan, "Where do you want this?" And they said, "There." So we thought, great. And we just offloaded it onto the side of the runway. But the thing was, when we flew back the next day, it was still there. Nobody had moved it. And we'd put another lot alongside it. And, I mean, this place was devastated. I mean, there were floods everywhere. And you couldn't help but wonder what ever happened to this? And were the authorities on a fiddle? You know, because we saw one load we put down. 4 days later, we're still there. But the flood relief went on, and that's what we were there to do.
Were you on the Ethiopian famine relief
no.
at that time?
No, no. Again. That came later. That came later. Mm. Yeah, the Hercules lads at Lyme. The lads with the flying lorries did that, yeah.
And what other? I mean, you went on a lot of these sorties,
yes,
you?
We did. Yes, we did.
What, to after Australia and places like
oh,
that?
Oh, yes, yeah. I was at Christmas Island and saw two atom bombs go off at Christmas Island. I'm still alive to tell the tale. The only thing is I glow in the dark, you know. But down to Woomera, taking odd bits and pieces down to Woomera. And then, of course, in those days, we used to stage through Gan in the Maldives. And I changed 9 fuel tanks on a Britannia in Gan. It developed a problem on takeoff, and they had to jettison the fuel, and the jettison the fuel, it clogged the vent lines, and the bags in the wings, being flexible bags, were sucked up towards the vent lines, and it tore all the bottom of the bags, so they had one wing completely useless, couldn't handle. So I had to go out there and change 9 bags of in temperatures of, I don't know, got pretty hot, because we rigged a canvas awning over the wing to keep the sun off, and it took about 6 days, completely from dawn till dark, to change all these bags. And on board, of course, was a rocket for Woomera, and because it had to be kept at a certain temperature. And so then we went out to Woomera, and back from Woomera, and then we come back to Lynham, and again, we did what we had to do.
Mm. You didn't have an engineering base at Gan, you know, with
no.
a big supply of spares.
No, no,
and stuff
no, no, like no, that. No. But we used to go out and rescue things from Paya Lebar Airport in Singapore, Comet 4 for once out there, and a Britannia, which had developed a problem in Singapore, which the lads in Singapore, through lack of experience and nothing else, couldn't rectify. And the boss said to me, can you go out to Singapore, he said, and rectify this problem? I said, well, tell me what the problem is. He said, well, apparently the nose undercarriage leg falls out in flight when they take off. Because with the Britannia, you'd get the undercarriage up, it would then lock up manually, and then you could offload the hydraulic system. But when they offloaded the hydraulic system, the nose leg would fall back out into the slipstream. So I went out, and I said to the lads, what have you done? And they said this and that. So I said, right. So I changed the leg, I changed the doors, I changed the uplock with a corporal I took with me. And I said to them, right, try it now. And they took off on air test, and they came back and they said, yeah, it's great. So I said, right. And we flew from, because it had been there for nearly a week now, and it was getting time expired on servicing. We flew from Singapore, Paya Lebar Airport, to Aden, which took us 23 hours and 29 minutes. And then, it was such a long haul. And you were going against the wind. Cool. And the endurance on a Britannia was exactly, 12 hours, 25 minutes. Yeah. And the endurance was only 13 and a quarter hours on a Britannia. And then we flew non-stop then from Aden to Lynham. And funny incident there on the way in. You always book in over Woodley, Reading. And called in, and we asked Lynham, and they said, it can't be you. You're the wrong flight number. And Lynham Air Traffic, this was. And we said, no, we're here. We're over Woodley. Permission to join the circuit. And they were still arguing. And we landed at Lynham, and we taxied around. And we pulled up outside air traffic control. And we opened the direct vision window, the DV windows. And we said, would you care to look out of the greenhouse upstairs? And they looked out. And we waved to them. And we said, this is the flight number that's in Singapore, according to you. And we taxied around a dispersal. And we had several incidents. But then after that, they decided then that the Hercules would come in. And they were at Thorny Island. and they would arrive at Lynham. So there wasn't a room for everybody. So they then decided to send the Britannia squadrons to Brize Norton. And I went over on the advance party, and the 1st Britannia arrived at Brize Norton, and of course we met all the wing commander and the people over there, the engineering, the station commander and everybody. And he said, okay, you're over on that side, which was the far side of the, towards Bampton. And he said, your first aircraft will be due in the morning. So I said, great. So this aircraft duly arrived, and we had a look at it, serviced it, turned it around, refueled it, and we offered it to operations as a serviceable airplane. And they said, well, we've got a load. So we said, well, load it. And we've got an aircrew ready to go. Anyway, we dispatched this aircraft, the first dispatch from RAF Brize Norton. And then about 4 or 5 days later, the rest of the aircraft followed on and came into Brize, and we were there then until the cessation, when the government sold the RAF Britannias and dispersed them.
What year was this when you arrived at Brize Norton? Do you remember?
68, 70, something like that. Yeah, something like that. I can't remember the actual date. But then I was, when they sold the Britannias, I then went to RAF St Athan. And I worked on major servicing of Vulcans down there. And incidentally, we also serviced the Battle of Britain flight Lancaster whilst I was there. And she had a terrible problem with the bomb bay doors. And we reskinned those whilst I was there on the City of Lincoln. And that went back to the Battle of Britain memorial flight. And we got on with our own servicing on Vulcans. And my term at RAF St Athan, we did major servicings on every Vulcan that we had in the Royal Air Force at that time.
So they would come down to St Athan's for a major service?
Yes, they would. Yeah. Yes, they would. Mm-hmm. Yes. And
what that involved? Engine changes?
Oh, everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Stripped to the last nut and bolt.
Really?
Yeah. We used to do a turnaround when I arrived down there on a Vulcan. It used to take 184 working days to do a turnaround, a major on a Vulcan. And this would involve peeling back the wing skins and changing all the formers, which used to corrode terribly over the wheel wells. The T-stringers and the Z-stringers were actually reducing almost to powder at times. Anyway, we used to change these, and we do a complete cockpit gut and redo the cockpit completely. Instrument panels, flooring, windscreens, change every windscreen in the airplane. And all the radar, all the bomb bay
gear. You'd be upgrading, I suppose, as you went as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The modification to them, when it left RAF St Athan's, was second to none. They had every device you could think of that had come out and been developed on them. And
how many hours would that Falcon have flown before you did this major? I mean, what was the service interval?
Something about 3,000 hours between major servicings.
Good God.
Yeah.
Only 3,000?
Yeah. And there's one now still flying in Lincolnshire somewhere, and it's owned by a civilian. And yeah, we used to...
I don't think they've got it. They're allowed to take it off the ground, are they? They can taxi it.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, these Vulcans, they used to fly to all parts of the world. We had a hot one. It just happened to be in Hong Kong at the time the Chinese atom bomb went off. And it came straight into St Athan's when it got back. But we had to seal the hangar because it was radiation on it. And we had to seal the hangar and keep everything separate for decontamination. I think I went through, as a warrant officer in charge of the servicing at that time, I think I went through something like about 600 pairs of overalls for airmen at that time. And we did three major servicings on every Vulcan whilst I was down there.
Just Vulcans, none of the others.
Just Vulcans, none of the others, just Vulcans, yeah.
Now, we were just talking about the servicing the Vultures, of course, and that radioactive one. Of course, just going back to your time in Christmas Island.
Yes.
I mean, did you actually see those two tests?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
How far away were you?
One of them was 80 miles, and the other was about 140. Because one was actually detonated short of where it should have, the DZ was, the drop zone.
Oh, it was a drop one, was it?
Yes. And it actually, it was an air explosion, and it was dropped a little bit short. But the great protective clothing we had in those days, flip-flops and shorts, and that was it. But we didn't actually see the bomb go off. We were told to sit down on the sand with our hands over our eyes, and this thing went off, and then you could get up and turn around and have a look at it. But it was incredible because you could actually see, although your eyes were shut and your hands were over your eyes, you could actually see the skeleton of your hands through. You find it hard to believe, but you can actually see the bones through your hands with the
your eyelids.
Yeah, through your eyelids. Yeah, and you had your back towards it. And when you stood up, there was this great column going upwards. And what you didn't realise at that precise moment, when you watched this thing going ever skyward, and then it flattened out with a mushroom on top, you hadn't heard the explosion at that time, and then it hit you. And the explosion was something like you've never, ever heard in your life before. And I never want to again. It was a deafening, ear-splitting roar of the like of which you've never heard. And the second one I saw was very similar, except that this was a detonation, again, an air detonation, but on the ground, this was.
Low altitude.
Yeah, yeah. And that one was, you knew what to expect the second time. But those that hadn't seen it before, it was a colossal sight. But when you see that you actually stood there, and this mushroom cloud went up and over your head, and in it you could see all the colours of the rainbow, these flashings going on inside this mushroom cloud. And the stem went up and up and up. And then the blast, the wind blast, hit you. And then about a couple of hours later, you'd get this tidal surge that would swamp the island, you know. But it only lasted, minutes. And then it went down again. But it was an incredible sight. It really was. Yeah. But I'm still alive today to tell the tale. As I say, I only glow in the dark. But,
what about the fallout, though? You're looking at this great cloud.
That's right.
It's chucking stuff down on you, isn't it?
No. Where we were at Christmas Island, the fallout went across further out. Because as the cloud drifted across, it took all the rubbish with it. And you were left in the vacuum between where the fallout occurred and where the explosion took place. And you were between the two.
What an experience.
Mm.
Now, going back to Bryars, presumably you were there when the tanker fleets arrived.
Mm.
Up to that time, the only aerial tankers were the V-bombers themselves, weren't
they?
That's right.
Each version
yes. had a tanker.
The Victors. The Victors.
They were Victors, but I think they had Valiant tankers as well earlier on, didn't they?
Yes, they had. Just one tank on a Valiant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when the Britannias were sold off,
yes,
the tankers came in, did they? Did the TriStars come in then?
No.
What happened then?
The Britannias got sold off at Bryars Norton. I was sent to St Athan. I did major Vulcan inspections.
Yeah.
And after I'd finished my term at RAF St Athan, I then went back to RAF Bryars Norton, and I went to the line to start with, because at those days it was four-shift system, and they had VC-10s on the line, and they had got a warrant officer in charge. So I was made...
These were passenger VC-10s.
Passenger VC-10s, and there were no tankers in those days. And then the wing commander sent for me, and I went up, and he said, "Can you go down to base hangar?" As you know, it's a huge hangar, 1,093 feet long, 98 feet high, and 151 foot in depth, and it would take 10 VC-10s in one go. And I went down there to the base hangar, and in those days we had an Andover squadron at Brize Norton as well, which used to do the guidance systems on runways. So we used to do major servicings on Andovers and VC-10s. And then when the Andovers were disbanded, we then, of course, from Brize Norton, the VC-10 was the aeroplane of the decade for VIPs. And everybody used to use them. Royalty, prime ministers, and everybody else. And we used to do the VIPs from Brize Norton. And in my time at Brize Norton, I had the Central Defence Studies twice. I had two royal visits. Her Royal Highness, Princess Anne, she came twice. And I had Prince Charles, he came whilst I was there. And I also had the honour of being sent for by the station commander, who said to me, Curly, we've got a problem. I said, we don't have problems, sir. And he said, well, tell nobody. But he said, we've been asked to do security for the President of the United States of America, Ronald Reagan. And I said, oh. He said, he's coming for the 40th anniversary of D-Day. So I said, and? He said, Upper Hayford can't oblige. He said, so we are going to do security for him. And I said, right. He said, now his senior security man is coming over. He said to have a look. And I said, okay. Well, he came and he introduced himself. And I said to him, come and have a look. He said, where are you going to put the Air Force One? And I said, it was Boeing 707 in those days. He said, well, Air Force One and Air Force Two are coming. I said, well, Air Force Two can go outside. I said, where everybody will probably think it's Air Force One. I said, so we can start the security with that. He said, that's a good idea. Where are you going to put Air Force One? I said, here in the hangar. I said, where it's warm, security complete. I said, refueled in the hangar. I said, it could be off. I said, in a matter of minutes, if you need it. What a good idea, he said. So anyway, Air Force One duly arrived, and we refueled it, and we pushed it straight into the hangar, and nobody had knew that it had arrived. And Air Force Two arrived about an hour later, and all the press were there.
So Reagan had got clear by that
time? He'd gone. He was in London. And I met the security men, and of course the thing with Americans is that they have guards. I mean, they had one aeroplane in my hangar, and they had five guards on the damn thing with submachine guns, which I wouldn't tolerate. I said, you have no weapons in this hangar. And they couldn't appreciate this at all. Anyway, I spoke to my station commander, who agreed with me, and we then got hold of the security man, and he agreed that they wouldn't have these weapons in our hangar. And the major, prior to Air Force One arriving, said to me, what sort of security have you got? And I said to him, any time you feel like it, Major, hit that red button on the wall, any time you want to. I said, and you can see they're all along that wall. I said, they're positioned at regular intervals all along the wall. And I said, choose your moment and do it. I said, then stand clear. So he hit this red button, and I said to him, right, now come with me. And the hangar doors closed. Security was paramount. We went outside the hangar, onto the apron, outside the hangar, where those... And my two flight sergeants came to me with a nominal role, and they said to me, all present and correct, sir. He said, we've got so many men outside the hangar. We've got this man and this man is in sick quarters. That one's at the dentist. This man is on leave, and so on. These are on education or whatever. So I said, thank you very much. I turned to the major, the security major, the USAF, and I said to him, right, now try and get back in. And he tried, and he couldn't get back in at all until I
went back into the office, or
back into the hangar.
Yeah.
Couldn't get anywhere near the hangar. Couldn't get open any doors. So he said, I went to this my lad that I had a corporal on security on the gate on the main door, and I said to him, how long was that? And he said, less than a minute, sir. 58 seconds to be precise. So I turned to the major and I said, is that enough security for you? And he said, thank you very much. Very impressive. Anyway, we had the 707 in the hangar for about a week. And President Reagan and Nancy came down from London. And they got aboard and off they went back to the States. But before they went back, President Reagan sent for me. And I met him on board the aeroplane. And he gave me a pair of solid gold cufflinks and the seal of the President of the United States of America in enamel on the cufflinks with his signature on the box and top, and a signed photograph of Air Force One from all the crew. Very impressive, yeah, very good. And then at Bryce Norton, as I say, I did all sorts of VIPs. I did 13 Royal VIP aircraft, including Prince Charles and Lady Diana, bless her, from the return of her honeymoon. And it was just prior to the 18 days before their wedding, my wife and I had an invite to a garden party at Buckingham Palace. And I said to my wife, drag your feet, I said, because we shan't ever be in here again. And we stayed right at the very back, and coming down the stairs was Lady Diana. And she tripped along the corridor and she said, good afternoon, stopped and had a little chat. And Prince Charles came along and he said, good afternoon. We said, good afternoon. And Diana said to him, this man knows where we're going on honeymoon, because it was very, very hush-hush, you know. So he said to me, how do you know? I said, because I'm preparing your aircraft at this moment, sir. And he said, oh, do you need to know? So I said, oh, yes. I said, because where you're going in Egypt, I said, they haven't got liquid oxygen facilities. So I said, we've got to get as much oxygen in that aircraft as we possibly can. So he said, how do you achieve that? So I said, what we do, we run the hose through a bucket of hot water. I said, which vaporizes the liquid. I said, so that when it goes into the bottle in the aircraft and cools down, I said, and reverts to a gas, I said, we can get that much more in. And he said, what an ingenious idea. And that really made our day. Really made our day. And then, as I say, I came and back to Bryce, and my very, very last trip out, the wing commander in charge of 10 Squadron said to me, he said, Curly, you've done me many, many, many favours in the past. He said, and it's about time I did you one. So I said, I understand. He said, you're leaving the Royal Air Force. I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, when? I said, January. He said, right. He said, Mrs. Thatcher. I said, yes. What about Mrs. Thatcher? He said, are you doing her aircraft? I said, yes, we are. I said, as usual. So he said, she's going to Shanghai to open the trade conference. I said, yes, I know she is. I said, because we need to know. And I went out through Gander, Calgary, to Hong Kong, and picked up the aircraft to Shanghai, and then back home again. And coming back into London Heathrow, now this was 2 days before Christmas Eve in 1984, I think it was. And she came back and met us, and I've got a signed picture from her. And yep, and that was my last time at RAF Bryce Norton.
And then you left the RAF?
In January 85. Yeah, after 39 years. Yeah.
John, well, that's a superb interview. We've just reached the end of the tape. Thanks very much.